Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Tonight's program is presented in partnership with the Lafayette Library and Learning Center's Glenn Seaborg Learning Consortium. You can find the club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Josh Richmond, politics and legal affairs reporter for the Oakland Tribune and Bay Area News Group, and your moderator for tonight's program. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our very special guest, Dan Walters. A copy boy in 1960, 50 years ago, Dan Walters, at age 22, was the nation's youngest daily newspaper editor. He joined the Sacramento Union's Capitol Bureau in 1975 as Jerry Brown became governor, later serving as bureau chief. He started writing the state's only daily newspaper column devoted to California's political, economic, and social events in 1981, and in 1984, he and that column moved to the Sacramento Bee. His column now appears in more than 50 California newspapers. His 1986 book, The New California Facing the 21st Century, since revised, has become a widely used college textbook about socioeconomic and political trends in the state. He is also the founding editor of the California Political Almanac, co-author of 2001's The Third House, Lobbyists, Money, and Power in Sacramento, and a contributor to this year's Remaking California, Reclaiming the Public Good. He's also a frequent guest on national television shows commenting on California politics. Please welcome Dan Walters. Thank you. So while we wait for the audience questions to start coming up, why don't we start by talking about the debates that we're about to see next week. We have the second Boxer-Fiorina debate and the first Brown-Whitman debate. What are your expectations for these face-offs?
Well, and by the way, thank you for inviting me to Lafayette. When I put Lafayette in my GPS unit, it wanted to send me to Lafayette, Louisiana first. But I got here, and what was the old Lafayette, I salute you? I think that was something out of the Revolutionary War, wasn't it? So anyway, thank you very much. So what are my expectations about the first gubernatorial debate? First of all, I'm going to take my cue about that debate from one of the participants, Edmund G. Brown, Jr., who once suggested that Californians should lower their expectations. And I've learned so far in this campaign for governor this year, particularly the campaign between Jerry Brown and Meg Whitman, that we should, in fact, lower our expectations if we expect to have these debates deal with any kind of substance. California is a very troubled state. It is, we have horrendous economy, 12.5% unemployment. The economists tell us it's going to be bad for years to come. There's no real light at the end of this particular tunnel. We have a state budget that is hopelessly out of balance. And I don't think there's a state legislator serving in Sacramento who remembers the last time we had a balanced budget, as a matter of fact. And that appears to be a chronic and even semi-permanent condition. We have a K-12 education system that, by all standards, is failing. We even have, according to new data that just came out today, among the nation's worst roads. The worst. San Jose area has the worst roads of any metropolitan area in America. And back to California's roads, says the Federal Highway Administration, are the second worst in the country, second only to New Jersey, where they kind of bury bodies in the road and it makes them kind of lumpy and so forth.
That's the Giants' end zone, actually.
Yeah, you know, that's a Soprano territory. At any rate, we have many troubles in this state that are economic and political and cultural. We have a governmental system that is dysfunctional. It's not dealing with these issues that I just mentioned or any of the others. We have a water situation, a water issue that hasn't been resolved for decades, been hanging around for decades without resolution. In fact, I wrote a column early last year when Meg Whitman announced that she was going to run for governor and suggested, at least semi-seriously, that anyone contemplating for running for governor in California should be required to undergo a psychiatric examination. In fact, Matt Lauer asked her about that when she was on the Today Show, and she was kind of flustered. She didn't really know how to answer that. Because, as we've seen with recent governors, most recently obviously Arnold Schwarzenegger, governing California is probably impossible under the pleasant structure of government we have. That there is a fundamental conflict between a structure of government that basically is democracy on steroids, giving every single interest group and every single issue a veto power over the product, and a state that is so complex that we can never achieve consensus on much of anything. It's a recipe for gridlock, and that's exactly what we have seen. And as Albert Einstein was reputed to say, I didn't hear him say it, I wasn't in the newspaper business then, that doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result is insanity. If he didn't say it, it's certainly evident, self-evidently true. And we keep doing the same thing over and over again, electing governors who will promise to us that they can govern, and then 7 or 8 years later we find out that they were wrong. Not necessarily lying, but wrong. So I have low expectations. I expect that because these issues are so daunting and so intractable, that they won't talk about it, that they'll basically fire bullets at each other of one kind or another and hope to persuade you, the voters, that the other person is the devil reincarnate. And although it may take the devil reincarnate to actually govern California. So I have low expectations. As it turns to the Senate debate, I think it tends to be a little more issue-oriented because it's more detached from the reality of the state. The senators have very little to do with the reality of California. They have to do with what goes on in Washington and foreign policy. And so it's kind of a detached sort of thing. So you can kind of get into the issues there because they know that the senators probably can't have very much real impact on those. So they can discuss how many angels can dance on the head of a pin forever. But the governorship is a little different situation. You're dealing with real issues that are right here. And we should hold them accountable for what they do and what they promise to do and make them say what they'll do. But probably we won't hear very much about that. That's probably a long answer to a very short question. I'm sorry about that.
Well, no, we like that. I think we like that. What about the influence that money is playing in both of these races? Much has been made of Meg Whitman setting the national all-time record for out-of-pocket spending, right. And it seems almost as if her numbers sort of plateaued at some point where she was spending a lot of money to make sure people knew her, but perhaps not all of the people who were getting to know her actually liked her. Do you see any sort of point of diminishing returns in that kind of thing? And do you think we've reached it in either race?
I think there is perhaps is a point of diminishing returns, although they do refresh her advertising quite frequently. You know, every week or so they have a new batch of ads. But I'm not one who sees a great deal of problem with money in politics, to tell you the truth. Ultimately, we vote for someone. Ultimately, they do the job or they don't do the job. And money is important, or as Jess Unruh said, it's the mother's milk of politics, but it's not the core. But we tend to think of politics as a kind of a game. You know, oh, they're up, they're down, they're behind, they're ahead. And by the way, you'll wake up tomorrow morning and read the newspaper and find out that they're tied in this particular case. But it's not really a game. It's supposed to be the means to the end of governance, of government. We tend to get all excited about campaigns, but they're really only supposed to be the means to the end of governance. And money might get you into the game. It's a prerequisite for getting into the game, whether it's your money or someone else's money. And California is an enormously complicated and difficult state to campaign in, very expensive state. But ultimately, somebody gets elected. And ultimately, somebody either has to do the job or doesn't do the job. So I don't get too excited about money. Money is only there as a means to the end of politics, which should be the means to the end of governance. It's kind of way down there in the priorities things. And we can get all excited about it, and people go, well, money this, money that, or this or that. there's a lot of extraneous stuff that goes on in campaigns, a lot of extraneous arguments. Well, she shouldn't be elected because she's putting all her money in. Or he shouldn't be elected because the unions are putting all the money in behind him. And ultimately, you decide on somebody, regardless of where they get their money, and ultimately they either do the job or they don't do the job. So I can't get too excited about money in politics. It's sometimes an excuse for not talking about the substance of politics.
And in terms of the substance of the gubernatorial race in particular, there seem to be a lot of people out there who feel that neither of the candidates has really enunciated much of a coherent plan. They have some general philosophies, but there's not anything that's really sort of a demonstrable plan on the table. And it almost seems as if, with all the negative advertising that's out there, it almost seems like, to me at least, a little bit of a replay of 2002, where Gray Davis figured he didn't have to be a popular candidate. He just had to be less unpopular than Bill Simon.
That's accurate. That's exactly how he approached the thing. And by the way, he only won by a quarter of a million votes. He came very close to losing with that. You're absolutely right. And this is the difficulty that we in the media have, because a lot of people in the media, frankly, are political junkies. They love this stuff. They love the polls and the intrigue and the back, who's up, who's down inside the campaign, and all the little gossip that goes on, and all those sitting around the bar talking about stuff. I'm not a political junkie. I don't give a damn about politics, really. To me, it's just a game. The real meat of the business is governance, is whether those potholes get fixed or not, whether the kids can go to school, whether we have a water supply. That's what's important. And what happens is that we get so tied up into we in the media, and to the certain extent the public, gets so tied up in all this minutia. It's her own money, he's spending that money, all this kind of stuff that goes on, all this kind of ins and outs and gossip and stuff like that, that we forget about. It's supposed to be about governance. And the candidates do it as well. Look at the charges and the countercharges. Did Jerry Brown raise taxes or did he not raise taxes 30 years ago? Or was she a good manager of eBay or a bad manager of eBay? Or does the owner of eBay didn't like her, won't vote for her? All this kind of stuff. But they should be talking about water and highways and schools and budget and things like that. And we get so wrapped up in the process of it, we forget about the substance, and they then don't have to give us the substance because we're not demanding it of them. And that's true of the media. And I kind of hate debates, to tell you the truth. Why do I hate debates? Because they don't really debate. What it is kind of like a news conference where they're responding to questions from reporters who are there to impress everybody with their erudition about these things. And what kind of questions do they ask of these things? Process questions. Well, you know, are you spending this money? Are you doing that? Are you doing that? They don't ask questions about substance. And they don't demand the answers about substance. I want to know how Meg Whitman and Jerry Brown will approach a $20 billion deficit in the state budget. This made us the laughing stock of the world. Well, they don't want to tell us that. They claim that they're going to fix the budget, both of them, but neither of them wants to tell us how they would do it or how they would approach it, because if they did, if they said, we're going to reduce the number of prison inmates by 30,000, or we're going to propose new taxes, or we're going to do this, or we're going to do that, everybody who would feel discomforted by that would come out of the woodwork and say, no, no, no. Because in the end, dealing with that causes pain to someone. You get less money from the state, or you have to give more money to the state. And people don't want to do that. And so the easy way to do it is say, we'll fix it. And it won't cost you anything. We'll root out all the waste and fraud.
And abuse. Fraud, and abuse.
We'll get the legislators together, and we'll all sing Kumbaya, and we'll fix it. And so we don't ask for very much of substance to these people. And it gets tiresome after a while to me. I think we non-junkies, should be demanding for these folks, both of them, to say, how will you govern? What do you intend to do? Not what the end result will be, but how are you going to get there? And we don't do that.
I'll confess to being a lifelong political junkie, but I consider myself in recovery, and I'm trying to make amends.
That's good. There's hope for you yet, Josh.
Let's move to some audience questions with that theme of substance in mind. We have a question. What can be done to curb the influence of public employee unions that are spending a lot of money and have been duly rewarded with generous pensions, wages, and other benefits?
Well, that's an issue. It certainly is an issue. Not so much that they have political influence. Everybody has political influence. They just exert theirs and beneficially. But you also can't overstate the issue. For example, my equipment says she would get rid of 40,000 state employees. Well, we actually have one of the lowest ratios of state employees to population of any state in the United States right now. It's 8.9, by the way, in case you wondered that. I'm going to lodge that away in your mind someplace. 8.9 state employees for every 1,000 people in California. It's not a high ratio. It's been higher many times before, including when Jerry Brown was governor, by the way. So he says she's only get rid of 40,000. Well, how are you going to do it? Worth employees? How much money? It really wouldn't save very much money, even if she did it, because the dirty little secret of the state budget is that it doesn't do much for the state. Most of the state budget is given away to somebody else. 40% of it or so goes to K-12 education. Another big wad of it goes to the colleges. Another big wad of it goes to counties, to health and welfare programs. Very little bit of that general fund budget, which is what all the angst about, is spent by the state itself. The biggest single item the state spends money on is the prison system. About $10 billion a year for 160,000 inmates. It was only about 20,000 when Jerry Brown was governor, by the way, 30 years ago. Although he put the first prison bond issue on the ballot, probably a big mistake. So this idea that state employees are somehow ruining the state budget just doesn't wash. It doesn't add up. That said, there are parts of what state employee unions want and protect that have a long-term impact, such as pensions. Because the pension system was increased sharply 11 years ago, in 1999. Gray Davis was paying off his public employee unions. He helped him get elected in 1998, and the next year he signed this big bill that raised state employee pensions dramatically, and most local governments followed right along, particularly in the police and fire ranks. And the cost of that is enormous. And the legislators were told by the state pension system that it would cost them nothing, that they were making so much money in the stock market, this would be a cost-free benefit. Well, it's about $5 or $6 billion a year now. And that's a significant chunk of the state budget. And the long-term costs are pretty horrendous. The state and three pension funds, teachers, UC, and the regular state pension fund, is probably, if truth be known, $400 or $500 billion underfunded. But nobody really wants to talk about that, do they? Because you're talking about cutting future pension benefits or raising the amount of money public employees have to pay in. And so it's just kind of, well, we're going to address that. It's kind of like the water situation. Every governor says, I'm going to address that. And then by the time that governor's gone, the next governor comes in, well, we're going to address that. You know, we're really going to work on that. It's just one of those things that nobody really wants to take on because of the political heat involved in it. And that's the sort of thing that the public employees do. Are they the end and be all of the state budget crisis? No, absolutely not. Are they part of it? Perhaps, particularly in the pension category. Are state employees overpaid? Not particularly. And they've been frozen, really, for a number of years. They're somewhat demonized, and they get very defensive about it, and then they demonize those who are demonizing them. But rationally, if you want to deal with the state budget crisis, you've got to look where the money is. Where's the money? Prisons, colleges, health and welfare, and K-12 education. Take your pick. There's where the money is. And if you're going to deal with it, you either have to raise taxes to cover your commitments to those categories, or you have to cut spending in those categories. Really, there's no way out. You can kid yourself all you want to, and you can demonize who all you want to, but there's where the money truly is.
On that note, another question from the audience. Would Proposition 25, which is the measure to reduce the legislative vote threshold for budget votes from 2/3 to a simple majority, provide any sort of solution to the budget issues that we have?
No. Proposition 25 doesn't do anything about the budget issues. The budget issues, as I just said, are either about raising taxes or cutting spending. Proposition 25 doesn't do either. All it does is allow the majority party to pass a budget. but they would still have to, presumably, although there's some legal dispute over this, have to get a two-thirds vote for any new taxes. I don't know why the Democrats want to get rid of the two-thirds vote. It doesn't make any sense to me. They do, but I don't understand why. If they get rid of it, then they can no longer blame the Republicans for holding up the budget. They then would be fully responsible for that budget. But they would not be able to raise the taxes to raise spending. They would be the ones that have to do all this cutting for the constituent groups that are their constituent groups, and they couldn't blame the Republicans for it. I don't know why they want to do it. That said, it's probably an okay thing to do. I mean, it doesn't solve anything, but, you know, it's a process issue. There is one section of Proposition 25, though, we ought to be really concerned about. You know, there's always this little sneaky stuff that's in these ballot measures. And this particular sneaky stuff says the simple majority vote would not apply just to the budget, but to all the so-called budget trailer bills. Any bills needed to implement the budget. But the decision on what is a trailer bill to implement the budget is up to the legislature. Which means that they could slip a whole bunch of stuff into these budget trailer bills that have nothing to do with the budget, pass them all with a simple majority vote, have them take effect immediately, and they couldn't even be subject to a referendum. Now, they already load up those budget bills with a lot of extraneous stuff. This would be an open invitation to load them up with a lot more extraneous stuff. It would be even easier to slip that stuff through. So I think that that's, if I were writing that, 20 simple majority on the budget, fine, period. Because I think this other stuff is just an invitation to more very, very dangerous mischief in the Capitol, as if they needed more opportunity to have mischief in the Capitol.
In a related question from the audience, which is certainly more of a political question than a policy question, would one party benefit more than the other from a budget delay that extends into the next governor's term?
It depends on who the next governor is. I think the budget situation will go to pass the election because so many things, like Proposition 25, on the ballot relate to the budget. For example, one of the other provisions of Proposition 25 says that the legislature will lose its salary and per diem payments during the time when the budget's overdue, right? Now, why would the Democratic Party, the majority of Democrats who want Proposition 25, want to punish themselves? There's only one reason. They put that in there to make it more attractive to voters, because voters would be angry about a delayed budget and vote for Proposition 25. Well, the longer the budget is delayed, the more powerful that argument becomes, that appeal becomes. In fact, the first ad for Proposition 25 that came out this week says exactly that. It really doesn't stress the getting rid of the two-thirds vote. What it stresses is punish the legislature for having a late budget. So there's every reason to believe that it might be delayed until then. What's really going on. If Mae Whitman were to be elected governor on November the 2nd, I would think the Democrats would want to make a deal with Arnold Schwarzenegger really, really, really fast rather than deal with her. On the other hand, if Jerry Brown is elected governor on November 2nd, I would think the Democrats would want to say, yeah, we'll just let the next governor worry about all this, because they would make a better deal with Jerry than they're going to make with Arnold Schwarzenegger. So who gets benefited? It all depends on who's elected governor on November 2nd.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with Sacramento Bee political columnist Dan Walters. If Meg Whitman wins the governor's race, what will be the one reason as to why she wins? Same for Jerry Brown. In other words, will a high turnout be the main reason that Brown wins, or will Meg's money be the main reason that she wins, or what?
I'm going to give you a little bit of advanced knowledge of some polling that I know about that hasn't been out yet, okay? Basically, they're tied. Basically, Jerry Brown wins in the San Francisco Bay Area, and basically Meg Whitman wins everywhere else right now. Now, one of them will obviously win by probably a very few votes, would be my guess. How will that happen? It will happen for Jerry if he gets a higher turnout than now is expected. There's a lot of there's an assumption that after Obama won California so handily and by such a large margin that wow, it's all over in California. Democrats are going to take everything. Well, that was then, this is now. This is a whole different set of dynamics. Obama's not as popular as he was then. Voter turnout's going to be lower than it was then, probably a lot lower by several million voters. One of the interesting things to note is that there are over twice as many registered Democrats in Los Angeles County as there are registered Republicans. But Meg Whitman's winning in Los Angeles County. And part of that is because they have the expectation of a very low turnout in Los Angeles County. So there are all sorts of dynamics at work. Basically, however, the main dynamic is this. The independents will decide this election. Jerry Brown will get probably 70% of the Democratic votes. Meg Whitman will probably get 80% of the Republican votes, which tends to then narrow the registration advantage for Democrats. And the 20% of voters who are declined to state, independents, are divided equally right now, and with about a quarter of them still undecided. They will be the ones who decide this election, which is why you see both candidates trying to appeal to independents who are kind of a middle-of-the-road sort of group. So Jerry's stressing the, I cut taxes, for example. He shouldn't have cut taxes, but he's stressing I cut taxes as governor. She's saying he left the state with a big deficit. So those are the sort of things that might appeal to moderate independent voters. They're looking for those kind of magic bullets that will resonate, will have some sort of visceral reaction with those voters. Whichever one of those candidates is more successful in doing that, however it's done, whether it's in a positive sense or a negative sense, will win this election and be the next governor of California. And God help them, whoever that is.
That's uplifting. Another thing that's playing prominently in this gubernatorial race is AB 32, the state's greenhouse gas emissions law.
It is indeed.
Prop 23, which would essentially roll that back. Meg Whitman has resisted thus far taking a firm position on Prop 23, but has said that as governor she would invoke the provision of the existing law that allows her to put a moratorium on implementation for a year in times of economic distress. Jerry Brown is holding yet another event tomorrow right here in the Bay Area, in fact, to talk about green jobs and how Meg Whitman wants to put AB 32 on hold. Do you think Prop 23 is going to succeed or fail from what you've seen? And do you think that this is an effective campaign plank for either one of the gubernatorial candidates?
Well, 23 is way up in the air, and it's a very important measure because AB 32, passed in 2006, is a very important measure. It would basically recast much of the economy of California in a different vein. Now, when it was passed in 2006, the economy was booming. We were rolling in clover then. Here we are 4 years later with Proposition 23 on the ballot, and the economy is in the toilet. So the circumstances are a little bit different. And you aren't hearing the people who oppose Proposition 23 talk very much about actual bill AB 32, or that what they talk about is don't let those nasty oil companies from Texas do this to you. It's kind of a appeal to kind of regional prejudice, I think, or something like that. And they say, and AB 32 will produce all these new green jobs. And the people who support Proposition 23 and oppose AB 32 or want to suspend AB 32 say, what green jobs? We've got 12.5% unemployment. Why should we be imposing all of this burden on employers in California, unlike any other state, or more than any other state, while the federal government is going to weigh this whole issue for the whole country? Why should we be the sacrificial lambs in a period with 12.5% unemployment? So both of those messages have some appeal, both the appeal, more green jobs, and the appeal is it could hurt the economy more. And obviously both of them are stressing those particular elements. I kind of doubt whether Prop 23 will pass, but On the other hand, maybe there's a legitimate argument for it. Maybe there's legitimate. Why should we be doing this with 12.5% unemployment? Why take a chance? And I don't know. It's a close question. Does it hurt or help them both, either one? Obviously, they think it does or doesn't. And so they're taking the positions that they do. Jerry Brown's going to be four square for AB 32 and against 23. Whitman's going to kind of waffle a little bit, but basically be critical of AB 32. Although she says she's going to decide and announce soon what her position actually is on Prop 23. It'll be very interesting to see. Before she was saying she was probably vote against it. Now it's kind of, I don't know. We'll see. But I don't know. I don't know that it's a... The only thing you could say about it is if the election is very, very close, then anything can tilt it either way, including Proposition 23. Jerry thinks that these independent voters that I mentioned earlier tend to be pro-environment and will be responsive to his position on that. Meg Whitman may think that a lot of unemployed workers might be responsible to her position, that this has damaged the economy more. But so if it's a real close election, it could tilt it. But then a lot of things could tilt any kind of a close election. Anything. And it could be, this could be an extremely close, a real down-to-the-wire, whisker-close election.
Let's talk a little bit about government reform. We have a couple of questions here, and we'll just lump them all together. What are your thoughts on the two propositions on November's ballot dealing with legislative redistricting, one which would roll back Prop 11, one which would expand Prop 11? What do you think about the recent open primary proposition, that was the top two primary proposition that was passed, and the failed effort to get a constitutional convention going? Do any of these
got
have
an
any
hour
kind
for
of,
about,
I'm sorry?
Got about an hour for all that?
Yeah. do any of these appeal to you as an actual useful means of reform?
Well, we do need reform in California. There's no doubt about it. I don't mean reform in the kind of the goody-two-shoes sense. That we need to reform, restructure our governmental apparatus. Think about it. We haven't changed a county boundary in the state since 1907 when Imperial County broke away from San Diego. We have had the same size legislature since the 1860s. Well, if 40 senators and 80 assembly members was right in the 1860s, it can't be right today. These districts they have are an immense district. We have 300-mile-long Senate districts in this state. I mean, it's undemocratic, if truth be known. You have no real contact with those you elect and represent you. We have a really screwy structure of government, even screwier than the federal government, I think. And we have a governor, but the governor only governs part of the government. We have the attorney general and the controller and the treasurer and all these other people who are separately elected, aren't on the same team, go at odds with one another. We have two-thirds votes on taxes and spending. We have the initiative, the referendum, the recall. We have gone checks and balances ad nauseum to the point of paralysis. Nobody can make a decision because anybody who doesn't like that decision will prevent it from taking place. They'll either block it in the legislature, they'll go on a referendum, they'll go to court. There's 1,000 different ways to stop things from happening in California and very few ways to make things happen. So we go on year after year after year with all these things, traffic, education, water, all these things, and nobody ever does anything about them. We need a system that has authority in the hands of those we elect and accountability for what they do. We have a wonderful system now for passing the buck. Governor blames the legislature blames the governor, assembly blames the Senate, they all blame the courts, they blame pass the buck like crazy, but nobody really is accountable for making a decision and held accountable for what that decision brings. So that's the kind of reform we need. These other things that were talked about most recently, open primaries, redistricting reform, are fine as far as they go. But they don't do anything about the basic conflict between our structure of government and a very complicated society. We have a system of government that was basically created in the 18th century for an agrarian, sparsely populated agrarian society in which only white male landowners could vote. And we try to adapt that to the most complex society, at least in the Western Hemisphere, and perhaps on this globe. And it doesn't work. And it can't work. And we should go back and try to create a new system that has some relevance to what California is in the 21st century. That would take a constitutional convention. But the same forces that make it difficult to govern California also make it different to have a constitutional convention. So we're in the horns of this dilemma. It's the California conundrum. These other things, like I said, redistricting reform, open primary, may have some effect on the margin, but they would not really change the fundamental conflicts that prevent us from governing ourselves effectively in this state. Now, as to redistricting reform and those two measures, that's kind of politics at its very basest. There's nothing baser, more fundamental, or rottener than redistricting. It allows, the way it's structured now, it allows politicians to pick their constituents rather than vice versa and lock themselves into office until they die in some cases, unless they have term limits. It's a rotten system. It's corrupt, and it creates corruption by its existence. We took a baby step out of that with this redistricting reform that creates an independent commission. You have no idea whether this commission is going to do the job right or not. It's an experiment. But what happened then is a man named Charles Munger, who is the son of the man who is Warren Buffett's business partner, Charles Munger Sr. Charles Munger Jr. is a physicist at Stanford University who has an interest in political reform. He put up a lot of the money for the redistricting reform originally when it was passed by voters a couple of years ago. He has put money into a ballot measure, Proposition 20, that would extend redistricting reform from the legislature and the Board of Equalization to congressional seats. Let the commission draw congressional seats as well. Now, they were left out of the measure 2 years ago because Nancy Pelosi and her colleagues said they would spend any amount of money to defeat it if they were included. So Arnold Schwarzenegger was pushing that thing and said, okay, we'll just leave you out. Munger would put them back in, would put Congress back into the commission. The congressmen of both parties, but particularly the Democrats, hate it. They just loathe it. The idea that some commission might interfere with their lifelong careers in politics. So they dreamed up this measure, Proposition 27, that would abolish the redistricting commission altogether and put it back in the hands of the legislature, their buddies in Sacramento, who would take care of them. But they really don't care so much about that as they are defeating Proposition 20. So all this money that's been collected to pass Proposition 27 is actually being spent to defeat Proposition 20. I know, it's crazy, but that's the way politics are. Now, you want to get really down and dirty. What is this all about? Why are these congressmen so afraid of an independent commission? Because white congressmen hold more than their share of seats in Southern California, white Democratic congressmen. And they've, I've got to use a word you can use on the radio. They've shafted the Latinos, basically. And they know that if the independent commission drew those districts, a lot of them lose their seats to Latinos, from white Democratic to Latino Democrats. And they don't want that to happen. And so they want to short-circuit that whole thing by either defeating Proposition 20 or passing Proposition 27 with a higher vote total so that 20 wouldn't take effect. It's politics at its basest level.
Ouch.
What it is. There's nothing more self-serving and pettier than redistricting legislative and congressional seats. I mean, all sense of morality, ethics, anything goes right out the window. This is sheer political survival of the fittest, basically. It's Darwinism in politics of the worst kind.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with Sacramento Bee political columnist Dan Walters. An audience member would like to know, is there any hope of changing Prop 13?
No. Prop 13 is going to... Ever since Proposition 13 passed in 1978, people have said, well, it'll be repealed someday. People will come to their senses. The courts will throw it out. It's not going to be there forever. It's going to be there forever. It's going to be over there forever because... wittingly or unwittingly, the people who wrote Proposition 13, Howard Jarvis et al., wrote in a self-perpetuating part to it. So your neighbor's here, he's sitting there with a low tax bill because of Proposition 13. Somebody buys a house next door and their tax bill's higher. And you say, well, that guy next door should want to repeal Proposition 13. No, the minute that guy buys that house, he starts getting the benefits of Proposition 13 because his taxes then are basically frozen or very close to frozen. So it creates its own constituency and explains why Proposition 13 is just as popular today as it was in 1978. And it's not going to be repealed. It's the third rail of California politics, just like Social Security is the third rail of national politics. It's not going to be touched. People can complain about it all they want to, and I'm not so sure it should be touched, to tell you the truth. Let me tell you a little dirty little secret about that. Since Proposition 13 passed in 1978, property tax revenues, not tax levels, not tax rates, but property tax revenues that go to local governments, schools, have risen faster than state revenues. Believe it or not. Why? Because of all that new construction. After Proposition 13 passed, total property taxes in the state were cut to about $6 billion a year. They're well over $50 billion a year now. So it was an unsustainable system. Something was going to happen in property taxes in California because it was politically unsustainable. If Proposition 13 had not passed and taxes were being levied at the same rate today that they were then as a percentage of value, property taxes in California would be up there close to $200 billion a year. It was unsustainable. Something had to happen. Now, it didn't have to necessarily be Proposition 13, but the seeds of that had been sown, and that was the harvest. The legislature had plenty of opportunity in the years leading up to Proposition 13, under Jerry Brown and under Ronald Reagan, for that matter, to do something about runaway property taxes in California, because they were going out of sight. Particularly in an era of high inflation in the late 1970s, when so-called house values were jumping like crazy. They didn't do it. They have only themselves to blame for Proposition 13's pass. They have plenty of opportunity to do something about moderating property tax increases. People have an emotional attachment to their homes, and they felt, rightly or wrongly, that they were being taxed out of those houses. So something was going to happen. And so, put it all together, no, Proposition 13 isn't going to be touched. It's not going to happen. It's going to be a fact of life, probably as long as any of us in this room are alive. And then longer.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the down ticket races briefly, particularly.
You want to test the limits of my ignorance?
Well, let's talk mostly about the lieutenant governors and the AG's races, the attorney general's
okay,
races.
Okay, let's.
In the lieutenant governor's race, you've got Gavin Newsom, the mayor of San Francisco, who's very strongly identified with the gay marriage issue and with a generally progressive bent. Very much part of the green jobs, clean energy economy message that Jerry Brown is trying to base his platform on as well, versus Abel Maldonado, a relative moderate, or so they say, who was responsible for getting that top two primary measure on the ballot.
Yes,
when he was in the state Senate, got that as part of a deal for his vote on a budget. From down there on the Central Coast, the appointed incumbent. What do you see happening there?
It's actually a little more interesting. Mostly, somebody said once, it wasn't me, but I've quoted it a couple of times. I wish I'd have thought of it. The job of lieutenant governor of California is wake up every morning, read the paper, make sure the governor's still alive, and find a service club to address. And that's truly, literally true. That's his only job. Just to be there if the governor dies, basically. And or resigns or whatever. And so...
Or flies off to Asia for a week.
Or whatever. And be acting governor for a few days. I could tell you. If I had the time, I could tell you a wonderful story about that. That's. Tell me afterwards. I don't want to take up the time. This is a little more interesting than usual. I was very disappointed that Gavin Newsom didn't run against Jerry Brown for this reason. The Newsom families and the Brown families are so totally entwined with one another, virtually the same family. Gavin Newsom's grandfather was Pat Brown's closest friend and chief fundraiser. Gavin Newsom's father, Bill Newsom Jr., is one of Jerry Brown's closest friends. He appointed him to the bench a couple of times, and so on. And they're also tied up with the Getty family, but that gets really complicated when you do that. So I was disappointed because it was like a nephew running against his uncle. And I thought it would be really, really, really interesting. But he didn't do it. Now, why didn't he do it? Well, maybe he didn't think he could win. Possible. There are people who suspect, and I don't know that I'm one of them, but I'm open to the idea, that maybe they have a deal, given the connections of the family, that maybe Jerry will just be there for one term. And if Gavin Newsom's elected lieutenant governor, he'll just kind of take over the mantle. If true, it makes the lieutenant governor's contest a little more interesting than it otherwise would be. The flip side of that is that were Meg Whitman to be elected, I think there's a pretty good chance that Romney would want her as his running mate if he's nominated for president 2 years hence. But she could only entertain that notion if she was not turning the state over to Gavin Newsom. So it's much in her interest, perhaps, to have Abel Maldonado there, and certainly willing to become governor should she go off to Washington to become Vice President Whitman. So it makes that whole thing a little more interesting than it otherwise might be, and just elect some guy who's going to read the paper, find out whether the governor's still alive, and find a service club, kind of like Cruz Bustamante was the lieutenant governor or something like that. Attorney general, kind of interesting too. Attorney general is a very, very important position in California, a very powerful position. It's one of those not governor positions that has a lot of power. And many of our governors and candidates for governor, like, for example, the current one, Jerry Brown, have been attorney general before they ran for governor. And Jerry Brown's father was the same way. And Neville Younger was attorney general, ran for governor. And John Van de Kamp ran for governor out of attorney general. And Dan Lundgren ran for governor out of attorney general. So it's kind of a stepping stone in California politics, a well-established path to the governorship or some other office. A very interesting thing happened this week. Bill Lockyer, who also used to be attorney general, now the state treasurer, had appeared before the San Francisco Chronicle's editorial board, and among other things, he thinks that Steve Cooley, the Republican, will win over Kamala Harris, the district attorney of San Francisco. Cooley has a very good shot at winning this race. He's very well known in Southern California. He's reasonably popular. Got a big boost this week when he took all those people out of the city of Bell and clapped them into irons. And he's a law and order kind of guy, but not a real radical, right-winger or anything like that. I think the guy's got a very good shot of winning the attorney generalship, and with that becoming the kind of governor-in-waiting for the Republicans, regardless of who wins the governorship, probably the most likely next Republican candidate for governor down the line could be Steve Cooley versus Abel Maldonado. Governor Abel Maldonado, who knows, right? So these are kind of the nuances of these politics. Very interesting. Both of them are kind of interesting.
Cooley, I think I read, is the first Los Angeles DA to win three consecutive terms since 1936 or some such thing.
That's only because they tend to only spend a term or two in there and then run for attorney general. Like Ethel Younger.
It just took him longer to get around.
Ethel Younger and John Van de Kamp and so on. So they don't hang around very long. Before they have a chance to get unpopular, they're off and run for something else.
Gotcha. One other thing I can say for the record, and with the caveat that some political promises are made to be broken, that Meg Whitman told the Mercury News editorial board yesterday that she absolutely unequivocally will not accept a position on a national ticket if she's elected governor of California.
Right.
Right. Okay.
But then she said, unless Abel's elected too.
Since we're talking about national elections, an audience member would like to know, will California ever be relevant in future presidential elections?
Well, probably not, but possibly yes. And I don't know if the question means the national election or the primary. We tend not to be relevant in the primary system because by common consent, all presidential candidates so don't want to campaign in California. It's so bloody expensive. You have to remember that until Bill Clinton came along in 1992, winning California with less than 50% of the vote, by the way, Republicans had won every presidential election in California dating back to World War II, the end of World War II, with the exception of Lyndon Johnson and Harry Truman. I mean, we had voted Republican. California was one of the most reliable Republican voting states in the nation. Could it happen again? Probably not. But I think under the right set of circumstances, it could be in play. We would take the right set of circumstances. But it's probably going to be considered a Democratic state pretty strongly. What you always have to remember about California is that both parties have been losing market share in the state. If you go back to the era when Jerry Brown was governor 30-plus years ago, Democratic registration in the state was almost 60%. And Republicans were down around 30%, almost a 2-to-1 ratio. Even in that era, however, Ronald Reagan won California. Jerry Ford won in California in 1976. So, you know, we tend to be a little bit odd in California when it comes to politics. We tend not to be strongly partisan, and we tend to vote for the circumstances and for the people who are on the ballot at that moment, not necessarily just simply do a straight party ticket or anything like that. So when you put that into the frame and you figure that 20% Democrats are down to about 43% now, Republicans are still where they were then in the low 30s, there's a lot more independent voters. They're kind of quirky. I mean, think about what happened when Obama was winning California 2 years ago. The same voters who are voting for Obama voted for Proposition 8. Quirky, right? Unpredictable. Fickle, maybe, even. And under the right set of circumstances, California would vote for a Republican for president again. The right set of circumstances. Maybe it would be if a popular Governor Meg Whitman was on the ticket, for example, or something like that.
Given the specter of a popular Governor Meg Whitman,
kind of doesn't roll off the tongue. Really, does it?
I suspect it probably didn't for the person who posed this question. Which of the governor candidates has the best chance of being effective with the legislature?
Genghis Khan, perhaps. When Arnold Schwarzenegger was elected, he sincerely, albeit naively, believed that he could be effective with the legislature. He told people that he would use his celebrity, he would go out and he would form his own coalition of legislators based on personal, you know, he would cultivate them personally. He would go to their districts, he would pose for pictures with their children, he would do all these things, he would take them to dinner, he would smoke cigars with them, he would do all these things, and he could overcome the partisanship and the polarization of the legislature. Boy, was he wrong. He thought he was the irresistible force meeting the immovable object and would move the immovable object. It turned out that the immovable object didn't move at all. Governors can propose, but the legislature disposes. And Jerry Brown's, I'm going to tell you, Jerry Brown's relationship with the legislature 30 years ago was very, very poor. His vetoes were overridden dozens of times. The last governor to have veto override in California was Jerry Brown, and it happened dozens of times, including on death penalty, for example. There is an institutional hostility between the legislature and the governor in a state as large as California, where you have a full-time legislature, where you have legislative leaders who wake up each morning thinking, I should be governor, not that bozo. You have this institutional friction. And I don't know that anybody can say I would be more successful. Jerry Brown claims he would be, that he would more or less do what Arnold Schwarzenegger said he was going to. He would cajole, he would cultivate, and so forth. Meg Whitman said she would just order, you will do this or else. I don't know that either would be very successful in either of those strategies. Professional politicians in the legislature respect basically one thing and one thing only: force, power. You've got to force them to do things. You've got to show that you will not be denied. And I don't know that either one of them is really truly capable of doing that. Certainly Arnold Schwarzenegger wasn't. He had to finally surrender and say, I'll take whatever you give me, but that's about it. He's kind of gotten tough again in his last year because he's got nothing to lose. But basically, he had to surrender to the legislature. I remember once, very early in his governorship, within the first couple of months, they had a little dust-up over the wording of a ballot measure having to do a spending limit. And he basically caved into the legislature. And one of the top staffers in the assembly came over to me at the back of the chambers and said, we just found out this governor's a wuss. And that was it. He was all done right about that point, basically.
I heard Meg Whitman say yesterday that her strategy for working with the legislature would be that she will wield her veto pen very, very liberally, basically sending back anything that doesn't have to do with the economy and jobs, public pension reform, government reform, and education. And that she believes that by not letting the legislature do anything else and just focus on those things, she can invest them with this sense of ownership so that they can take credit for fixing things according to the plan that she's going to put forth. Does that sound viable to you?
No.
No.
It doesn't work. she would be dealing with people who are from a different planet than she's from. They have a completely different set of values than she does, a completely different mindset about government and taxes and that sort of thing. And they have to look behind them at the people who put them in those positions in the legislature. And they're basically people who, particularly the public employee unions, who have a vested interest in maintaining flows of money and the way money is distributed and all those sorts of things. And to think that a governor is going to overcome the pressure that they get from in back of them on these kinds of issues is, it just doesn't wash. It just doesn't make it. Remember when Arnold Schwarzenegger denounced the legislature as a bunch of girly men? How could we forget, right? Well, that's what he was talking about. He was talking about them being so beholden to the people who got them their legislative positions, primarily the unions, public employee unions, that they were totally beholden and had no freedom of action, no freedom of will, that no matter what they wanted to do individually, they were stuck in doing things the way the people who put them in office told them to do. And it was a little overly dramatic, but it was pretty close to the thing. Look at when Daryl Steinberg, the very liberal president pro tem of the state Senate, has occasionally gone off the reservation vis-a-vis the California Teachers Association and proposed things in education that they didn't like. And there's like a ton of bricks came down on him. They started sending mail to his constituents. They put up billboards. And just, how dare you? How dare you, Daryl, not follow the line that we put in? And it's you cannot overstate that. That is what it is. And so, but Meg Whitman thinking that she's somehow going to overcome that is not logical, with this possible exception that if this independent commission creates a series of legislative districts and when you have a larger block of moderates that aren't locked in liberal Democrats or locked in conservative Republicans, then she might have a chance there. That's why Schwarzenegger sponsored the thing. That's what he wanted to create. But at least for the first 2 years, those people aren't going to be there. Those wouldn't take effect until the 2012 elections at the earliest. So at least for the first half of her first term, she would be stuck with what it is now. And she would find, as did Arnold Schwarzenegger, that you cannot move an immovable object. It just doesn't work.
An audience member poses a question which probably is on that knife edge between politics and governance that you talked about earlier. But Meg Whitman says that Jerry Brown's tenure as mayor of Oakland was a failure. What is your opinion?
Oh, I think Jerry was an okay mayor of Oakland. He probably not as good as he says it was, as bad as she says it was. But I've got to tell you a funny story. On the day that he announced for mayor of Oakland, he signed off of his radio show there in his kind of office building studio come commune there on Jack London Square. And he came downstairs, and all his young acolytes were surrounded him, and of course his famous aide, Jacques Barzaghi, was there. "Hello, Mr. Walters," Jacques said. And so he goes on. Jerry's, "I'm going to run for mayor of Oakland because I want to do this and I want to do that." And he started talking about this freeway that cut through the middle of Oakland and divided the city. And so he said, I said, "Jerry, wasn't that you that built that freeway?" And he looked at me and he said, "I knew I wasn't going to be happy seeing you show up here today." So I, you know, Jerry is kind of a perpetual college sophomore. And his mind wanders here and it wanders there. And this thing is so interesting today, and tomorrow something else is so interesting. And Oakland was a kind of a little laboratory for him to tinker in, you know, and play around with some of the things he couldn't do as governor. And he wanted to form a military school, so he did a military school. And he wanted to do this, and so he did that. And he did this, and he did that. He probably wasn't the worst mayor Oakland's ever had. I mean, God, they've had some really bad mayors in Oakland. But I don't. He was bored with radio. He wanted to do something else for a while. He was there, and it was his for the taking. And so he did what he always did. He just said, "I think I'm going to go do something else for a while." And that's what being mayor of Oakland was all about.
Do you think Arnold Schwarzenegger has a political future?
Well, depends on how you define politics. Or as Bill Clinton said, depends on the meaning of is, right? Politics, yes, in the largest sense. I think you will see him in the political sphere for some time to come. And he said that. He said he's not going away. He's going to be around. He's going to have ballot measures. He's going to pursue this cause and that cause and whatever. I think he wants to stay in politics. I don't think he has any intention of running for office necessarily. Now, with one caveat, were Dianne Feinstein to retire in 2012, that probably would be tempting to him to run for the Senate. But in the absence of that, I kind of think that maybe in the back of his mind he thinks about being kind of the roving ambassador of global warming or something like that, where he can travel around the world and bask in the glow of these admiring crowds like he was in Asia last week, for example. And after he gets out of California, he's still a very popular figure. I mean, he's, you know, people, he's a celebrity. We're kind of used to him now. It's just Arnie, you know, but he is. And so I think, and he loves that. He just loves that sort of stuff. And he probably, I mean, he went off to, in the middle of a budget crisis with no bills left to be signed. He just took off for Asia for 8 or 9 days. I mean, he loves that. He just loves that. And so I think you'll see him around. He's not going to fade away. But he'll have to, because won't have office anymore, he'll have to kind of go into a different mode than he is now.
You really think he'd be interested in being in the Senate, where he has to build consensus on things rather than being in
senators don't build consensus on things. Senators grandstand and go on Meet the Press and pontificate. And I mean, look at that's what senators do. It's a big debating society, you know. And you're there, and you're a big important person, and everything. They don't actually do anything. Think about it.
Well, we'll be sure to keep that in mind for the senatorial debate next week. Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there's time for only one last question. I've been saving this one for last.
This is the zinger, right?
In the interest of perhaps leaving on a high note, an audience member would like to know, where's the hope and what might it look like?
Well, this is my job. My mission in life is destroy all hope. See? Remember the thing in Vietnam where you had to destroy the village to save it? Well, we have to engage in some creative destruction in California. We have to eliminate just these calcified layers of government and things that have been built up over the years that prevent us from being as effective a state as we could be. And so my job is to try to show you the inanity of the status quo. The insanity of the status quo, and the hope is that you will see that, and that you will rise up in righteous indignation, demand a constitutional convention, and fix it. So that's the hope.
The likelihood of the hope?
Likelihood of the hope is about the same as Lake Tahoe boiling, probably.
See, I couldn't let you leave it on a completely hopeful note.
Well, there may be a
right?
volcano under Lake Tahoe. Do you ever think maybe that's just a caldera ready to explode?
I in fact had not considered that possibility, but I'm sure that the candidates are looking into that as a possibility.
I always thought you should plug a hole in the side of the mountain and just have that water spurt over into the valley, and we could have plenty of water then.
Well, our thanks to Dan Walters, political columnist for the Sacramento Bee.
Thank you.
We also thank the Lafayette Library and Learning Center and our audiences here and on the radio. I'm Josh Richman, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.
All right.